Our scripture reading this morning comes from two places, from 1 Peter chapter 2 and from 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Two different writers, a common theme. Simon Peter first, it's printed for you there. Present yourselves as building stones for the construction of a sanctuary vibrant with life. The old translations say living stones, in which you'll serve as holy priests, offering Christ-approved lives up to God. You are the ones chosen by God, chosen for the high calling of priestly work, chosen to be a holy people, God's instruments to do His work and speak out for Him, to tell others of the night and day difference He has made for you, from nothing to something, from rejected to accepted. And then Paul from 1 Corinthians 3, you realize, don't you, that you are the temple of God, and God Himself is present in you. No one will get by with vandalizing God's temple. You can be sure that God's temple is sacred, and you, remember, are that temple. The Word of God for the people of God. Dateline, Bainbridge, Georgia, August 12th, 2015. A 92-year-old woman is no longer allowed to worship at her church where she has been a member for more than 50 years. Josephine King received a letter from Bainbridge's first African Baptist church that began, quote, Josephine King is no longer considered a member of this church as she has shown non-support towards the church in the areas of constant and consistent financial and physical participation. The letter was signed by Senior Pastor Derek Mike. Ms. King, in her admission to reporters, stated that she knew she had not been giving as she should, though for decades she had done more than her fair share, and she also admitted that she had not attended the church as she should for the last several months, as she had been an invalid at home. Several requests for comment from the church were made, but there have been no responses by officials, pastors, or any other members. I guess it's always been that way. There are those in the church who are much more concerned with money than anything else. Not everyone, but enough that it makes us all a little bit cautious. And while this story of Ms. King is rather extreme, it is not unusual for churches, in fact, it's the accepted practice, actually, for churches to take financial pledges and commitments from the members, and if said members don't pay up, they receive a letter. Many of you in this room over the years have shared that exact experience with you. You made a pledge, but then you didn't or couldn't give your total contribution, so you were dunned. You were billed for it. You weren't excommunicated, maybe, but shamed. And I'm not unsympathetic to this, the shaming, yes, but the pledges, no. I've been a pastor for more than 20 years, and I understand the practical financial demands of such things. I've worked for United Way and for Habitat for Humanity, and I've had my own not-for-profit, and none of these organizations and thousands more like them, like the Vanderbilt Foundation, where my friend is here today, he might raise money today and shake you down for you before you leave, particularly if you have any Nashville connections, just as a word of warning. None of these organizations can do their work without people giving generously to the cause. We all recognize and accept this, but I think most of us would be and are repulsed by how Ms. King was treated. A decades-long member in good standing gets aged and infirm, and rather than coming to her and helping her, praying for her, supporting her, they kick her out. She was no longer of any use to them. If you can't put your rear end in the seat, more importantly, if you can't put your dollars in the plate, well, we're striking you from the rolls. Good riddance to the extra baggage. Now, of course, I think if she were to show up some Sunday, if she had the strength and the health ever again to do so, and dropped a big fat check in the basket, I'm sure all would be forgiven. Don't you think so? It's not much different than the old medieval practice of indulgences by the Catholic Church that they used to fill their coffers. The practice has been altered and reformed all these years later, but 500 years ago, you could pay your way out of punishment. We have an indulgences in our society today. You know that, don't you? It's called a six-figure attorney. And if you can afford the right attorney, you can probably pay your way out of some of the punishment that you probably deserved. But I digress. An indulgence, according to Catholic dogma, is an act or an investment that diminishes the temporary suffering and or punishment for a sin. You commit a sin, you have to pay for it. Through penance in this life or purgatory in the next. But you can do less penance, you can spend less time in purgatory if you give an indulgence. Now, it's a great deal for the sinner if you've got the cash. Why pay with flesh and blood? Why burn, even though purgatory is not as hot as hell, why burn an extra century when if you've got the money, you can give the indulgence to the church and diminish your suffering? Well, of course, you can see that this kind of system is open to all kinds of extortion and abuse. By the late Middle Ages, there were professional pardoners who traveled all over Europe. And they were priests who would arrive in town like a tent meeting or a circus passing through. And they would set up shop and the pardoner would hear confessions. And then with the Pope or the bishop's stamp of approval, he would grant clemency to the repentant for the right donation. One story involves a pardoner who had apparently found a particularly sinful town. Everybody there was in trouble of some sort, and they just line up to make confession and put their money in the box. And he hears all these confessions, and he collects all this huge amount of money, and he puts it on the wagon, and the wagon is creaking down the road as he moves on to the next town, and he meets a traveler who falls immediately on his face and wants to make confession. And so the pardoner priest stops to hear the confession, and the traveler says, "Father, can I be forgiven in advance for a sin I'm about to commit?" And the pardoner says, "That's a bit unorthodox," but he had a wad of cash. And so he gave the cash. He was absolved of the sin he was about to commit. The pardoner threw the change, the money, into the wagon and turned around and was robbed by the man who had just made confession, and the priest pardoner protests and says, "Don't you realize that you're taking God's money?" And the man says, "Of course I do, but God's already forgiven me for this." These type of abuses, that's a pretty good deal too if you want to be a bandit. These type of abuses would lead directly to the Protestant Reformation. That we are sitting here today outside the umbrella of any official state church or religion is the straightway result of the indulgence system. What first provoked Martin Luther to rebel against the church, which eventually led to the Lutheran Church and the Presbyterians and the Anglicans and the Episcopal and the Baptists and the Methodists and the Free Churches and everybody else that's not Catholic, had nothing to do with doctrine, not at first. It had everything to do with money. It was the straw of selling and purchasing salvation that broke the camel's back. And Luther and a particular pardoner named Johann Tetzel, who was one of the church's best fundraisers, had come to fiery exchanges about Tetzel's fleecing of the flock. Tetzel had a little marketing brochure. I'm not making this up. The printing press had just been invented. And he had a little marketing brochure, a handbill, that he would hand out when he arrived in a village. And on it, it had this little poem: "As soon as a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs." How nice. So not only can you do an indulgence to help yourself, pay enough, and you can help a loved one who's already passed to the other side to get them out of the little trouble they've obviously caused for themselves. And it's a powerful motivation to raise money. If you have people convinced of that and you tell them, "Look, for a little cash, your grandmother is still in purgatory after all these years, and you've got the money to get her out. How could you do that?" Everybody just starts past the collection plate. And Luther, it was more than Luther could stand. And when he wrote up the 95 Theses on the Wittenberg church door, at the top of the list, the very first thing was about the indulgence system that was so abused by the church. So what did the church do with all of this money? Some of it went to Rome to support the administrative and bureaucratic structure of the church. Some of it, sadly, financed the Crusades. That money was converted to armies marching in the name of the cross, who kept marching into the Middle East trying to liberate Jerusalem from the Muslims. And as another digression, so many of our problems in the 21st century today are the result of that practice 1,000 years ago. But most of the money was used to build cathedrals. Most of it became brick and mortar, timbers and stone. St. Peter's Basilica was built with indulgences. Most of the Gothic chapels and cathedrals all over Europe, Durham Cathedral, Reims, Seville, the Sistine Chapel, all built by the confessions, heartfelt confessions of God's people who then paid money to alleviate their guilt, and that money built the great cathedrals of the world. Now, they're beautiful. And if you've ever stood in front of a Gothic cathedral, you recognize the beauty. They are a work of engineering and aesthetic beauty. They are incredible. It just feels a little bad that they were built with dirty money. And I wish that the emphasis had not been so much on church as a place, but on church as a people. And such abuses would have never been possible. You are the building stones of God's sanctuary. That's the verse we just read. Peter told the early church that. Now, this is the same Simon Peter whose name is now attached to a physical building in Rome that is the second largest church in the world, paid for with indulgences. God love him if he knew about it. You are the building of God. You, not a cathedral, not a fancy church with a spire or a nave or a narthex or a steeple. Who came up with those words anyway, by the way? It's you. And Paul is just as forceful. You are the temple of God, and God Himself is present in you. And if you go all the way back to the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah said, "The Almighty does not live in houses made by human hands. Heaven is His throne. The earth is His footstool. What are you going to build that could contain Him?" Nothing. No matter how majestic the cathedral, no matter how elegant the church, He won't fit inside. He has chosen to make His dwelling place, His sacred space, within you and within me. It is a marvelous thing. Wes King writes, "You live on the highest mountain. You swim in the deepest sea. You dwell in the grandest canyon, and yet you make your home inside of me. You call to the leaves in springtime. You speak to the kings of men. You breathe life into a baby, but you make your home inside of me. You walk through the starry heavens. You run to the soul that seeks. You climbed the hill of sorrow, and yet you make your home inside of me." So if we are going to put our time and energy and money into anything, let's put it into people. That seems to be where God does His best investing. Not in things, and resist the temptation to make faith about monuments that we might build. The building we are working on is the human soul. It is not a physical building. It's about people like Josephine King, not an organization that kicks someone to the curb when they can no longer be productive. Still, buildings are needed, or at least a place to gather is needed. Our own Brian Kennedy. Is Brian here today? He's in Brazil. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, yeah. Brian's in Brazil. Matt's in New Zealand. The life of musicians. Man, that is great. Brian Kennedy said it best. In fact, it was the first time I ever met him. Bobby Raines had made the introduction, and we were sitting at lunch together, Bobby, myself, and Brian. And I was trying to explain to him the concept of a simple faith. Go try that sometimes with somebody. Have you ever tried? Well, tell me about your church. It's harder than it appears, even for me. And so I'm trying to explain that, you know, we're Christians, you know, and we do Christian stuff. And we're church, but we're not like that church. And so I was just trying to explain all of that to Brian. And Brian had that massive cowboy hat on that he wears, nodded his head. Then he said, yeah, you know, I like that because, you know, I'm not really into church. Then prophetic words. I'm not really into church, but I wouldn't mind, you know, piling up with some folks every now and then. Only someone from Shreveport, Louisiana can say that. Well, you got to have a place to pile up. And our history has been that we usually piled up, stacked like cordwood, like we are in here today. Let's recount. We began around a kitchen table. And remarkably, some of the faces that were around that table are still in this room. We moved into a bank building lobby that became a Snappy Turtle store. We moved into a supermarket storefront that became a liquor outlet. We're good for the community, man. We moved into a wedding hall, a building apparently built to have the worst possible acoustics in the history of the world. We moved into an actual church, a real church with a steeple and everything. But we were loud and rowdy and messy. And now here we are in what is nothing but a long walk-in closet that used to be a school, that used to be a call center, and who knows what it's going to be in the future. We haven't been picky. We just need a place to pile up. Investing all along more in people than in buildings, but we've reached the end of the road. We have grown, thank God for this, to a point that we face two equally challenging dilemmas. Number one, the space we can afford, we can't fit. The space we can fit, we can't afford. Commercial real estate on the conservative side, $20, $25 a foot. We need 5,000 square feet. Do the math. $10,000 a month in rent. That is preposterous. That goes against everything we ever want to be or anything we ever want to do. Plus, just finding this sort of space has been impossible. I mean, while BP's spewing oil into the Gulf and the economy's in the toilet, you can just go pick your spot down here. That is not the case any longer. So it's tough. But after much prayer and searching and deliberating and wrestling, cue Willie Nelson singing On the Road Again. Because we have found our next meeting location. On the back of your bulletin today, there's an excellent little map, not that topography will be a subject I will be taking up anytime soon, that shows you the next stop in the Simple Faith Express. And baby, it has location, location, location. Go back up to Highway 98. Proceed west toward Destin. After passing through the Highway 331-98 exchange at the red light there at the Visitor Center in the Tom Thumb, you'll come to Blue Mountain Road, 83, south. Everybody knows that as the Blue Mountain Road. Did you know that Blue Mountain Road not only runs south, but it runs north? What? It does. And a few hundred yards down that little road is a little commercial industrial park with about three buildings in it right now, beach services, things like that, and the artist Justin Gaffrey's warehouse is there. Not his studio, his warehouse is there. And soon, a Simple Faith will be there. Located, I'm happy to report, in a 6,000 square foot warehouse with worship space for nearly 300, a kitchen, a small dining hall, space for children's ministries and Bible studies, adequate parking. There's only one catch. We got to build the building. You see, when you can't find what you're looking for, you just have to do it yourself sometimes, which is sort of the pretty good phenomenon for how simple faith got started in the first place. Okay, a few of the particulars. Are you ready? Number one, through the generosity of an individual, we were able to purchase a 6,000-square-foot zero land lot last week. This person didn't give us the money. It was lent to us, about $200,000, but it keeps us out of the traditional banking. And, buddy, we all want to stay out of traditional banking. No offense to the bankers in the room. I'm sure you are all remarkably honest people and do not sell indulgences. And on that land lot, we will build our next place for gathering. Now, it's going to be a nice facility. It's going to be a very practical facility. It will not be a cathedral. It will be a multi-purpose building that can accommodate what we do, plus we hope in time be a fantastic venue for music, for the arts, be a place where tutoring and other outreach can be done. It will have showers so a mission team or, God forbid, a hurricane relief team can be housed. It will be a warehouse, a simple, functional, metal-plated warehouse where we can pile up and then disperse to the community. No steeples, no naves, no narthex, no parquet flooring. Is that understood? Those things are nice. But number two, because it is practical, it will be affordable. Our best estimate, land and construction, is between $500,000 and $600,000. Do the amortization. Rent for the adequate space for us is $10,000 a month. If we had to pay it at that rate, how long would it take to recover your expenses? Not that long. So if you spend $125,000 a year in rent, money that is simply gone is incredibly impractical when in a few short years we can recover that. So no one is going to get fleeced in this process. We are not taking pledges. We are not running a capital campaign. We are not sending out bills or reminders. We are not shaming anyone into doing anything. We aren't making great promises if you give. We are not putting little gold tags on everything in the building. That's the Baptist in me talking. I apologize for that, but you know.
I gave that piano to the church. My granddaddy's name is supposed to be on it. You can't move it from that spot. We are avoiding that nightmare from the beginning. All right.
Sensible, affordable, practical. Three, we do need your help. I'm not going to stand up here and say we don't, but I swear on this iPad and the scripture it contains, I swear, and God is my witness, and may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I do not keep this promise. You will never be pressured. Never. You will never be manipulated. You will never receive a letter from me, and if anyone else sends you one, it's unauthorized, saying how, since you haven't done your part, you have to go. That will not happen. It will be business as usual, emphasizing that mission of ours conceived 8 years ago this very month, to worship God, follow Jesus, and serve others. This building is simply a tool to that end. But the last thing, this building is not the end. Oh, we own something. This is it. We can finally settle down and we can finally call a place our own and never worry about moving or singing on the road again. Wrong. This is a temporary home for a while. We don't know how long it'll last, but given our growth, we'll be doing this again in a few years. That's a good problem. But when you got no place to meet and you can't find the place to meet, we have to go and do it ourselves. And it's going to be great. Now, when? The big question. When are we moving? I don't know. Building plans, engineering plans have begun, and we will proceed at the pace that we can. That depends on timelines, weather, money, all those factors. We're not in a hurry. Susan Thornton wanted to be in by Christmas. And she still holds that over my head every time we talk about it. I'm kidding. That would be wonderful. That would be great. Maybe, maybe not. Easter, maybe, maybe not. Next summer, maybe, maybe not. Hey, that's not the point. Our goal is not to end up somewhere. Our goal is simply to have the space and the platform to do what we do. and open it up to the community, because church isn't a place. Church is a people, and you are that people. And you've proven over 8 years that you could meet just about anywhere. And let that spirit never be lost with this group.